We'll go to Matthew 26 in just a minute, verses 63 and following. But let's start in Mark 14. So if we go to Mark 14 and go down to verse 58, so go a little bit down in the chapter, where are we at in the context real quickly? Where is Jesus at this moment? Anybody know? Yes, so he has been brought in before the high priest. He at this point has been arrested by the soldiers. He's been brought before the high priest. How many trials did Jesus go through? Anybody have a guess at that? How many trials did he actually endure before his crucifixion?
Three, right?
And you could argue maybe four, because he's brought before the Sanhedrin, and twice he's brought before the Sanhedrin, once that night and then again in the morning. Then he goes before Pilate, then he goes before Herod, and then he's brought back before Pilate. So you could guess up to five different little trials that he goes through before he's led away to be crucified. So when that night began, just for a minute, I mean, just get into the standpoint of where Jesus is. And can you imagine how tired he is by the end of all of this? Number one, you've lost a whole night's sleep. Leading up to that, you've endured the stress and anxiety, right, that's displayed in the garden. He's arrested. He's abused throughout this whole time period, kept awake through all this, and tried five different times. I mean, that must have been just agonizing just to go through that part. That's not even got to the worst of it. But he comes before the Sanhedrin, and let's read, somebody read 58 and 59, please.
We heard him say, "I will destroy this temple made with hands, and within 3 days I will build another made without hands." But not even then did their testimony agree.
Okay. So it's also interesting as you go through this and you study the text, is the different ways he's, or the different things he's accused of and before whom. The way he's being tried before the Sanhedrin is going to sound very different than when he goes before Pilate. Why?
Religious.
Yeah, and all of it's really a matter of law, isn't it? Depending on who you're before. Before the Sanhedrin, what law is he being tried under? Yeah, the Mosaic law, right? Supposedly. And when he's before Pilate, what law? Roman law. And so those accusations are going to sound very different. Now, another important difference to note is, what was the limiting factor with the Sanhedrin? Where was their stopping point?
Death.
They couldn't execute. They could do lots of things underneath that, but they could not enforce capital punishment. But we know that for the Jews, it's not enough just to arrest him. They had in mind, we have to kill him. And so they're not just going to try him and put him into one of their prisons or whatever they're going to do to him, excommunicate him or anything like that. They have execution in mind. And so they know, number one, we've got to convince our own people. But once we do that, then we've got to push forward to Roman law. And so what's their first attempt at accusation? And according to Mark 14, And what would that be considered under Mosaic law?
Blasphemy,
right? He's blaspheming the temple. And of course, you go to Matthew 25 and you look at that context of what he's talking about. What was he talking about when he said, you'll destroy this temple and in 3 days I'll raise it up? Matthew clues us into what he meant. What was it?
His own body.
He's talking about his crucifixion, not the temple. Although in the text, he's been talking about the temple, but when he gets to that section, that's not what he intends. So their first attempt at accusation is regarding the temple. However, does that work? It doesn't work because Mark notes that they're even what they're trying to do, it doesn't agree. Like one saying one thing, the other saying, and their stories aren't lining up. And under Mosaic law, how many witnesses had to be there for an accusation to hold up?
Two or three.
Two or three, right? And they can't even get two witnesses to agree on the details. And so the first one doesn't hold water. All right. So after that, the high priest placed Jesus under oath and questioned him regarding the claims he had been making. And tries a different tact. Go over to Matthew 26. All right, let's start at verse 62. Somebody read 62 through 68. Somebody mind reading that, please.
And the high priest arose and said unto him, "Answerest thou nothing? What is it which these witness against thee?" But Jesus held his peace, and the high priest answered and said unto him, "I adjure thee by the living God, that thou tell us whether thou be the Christ, the Son of God." Jesus said unto him, "Thou hast said. Nevertheless, I say unto you, hereafter shall you see the Son of Man sitting on the right hand of power, and coming in the clouds of heaven." Then the high priest rent his clothes, saying, "He has spoken blasphemy. What further need have we of witnesses? Behold, now ye have heard this blasphemy. What think ye?" They answered and said, "He is guilty of death." Then did they spit in his face and buffeted him, and others smote him with the palms of their hands, saying, "Prophesy unto us, thou Christ, who is he that smote thee?"
Okay, so the first attempt is about the temple that doesn't hold up. And then what tact does the, or accusation does the high priest go with? What's he being tried on here?
They really want to know who he is.
Okay, they're asking who he is. And what's the accusation in asking that?
Son of God.
Yeah, they're accusing him of claiming to be the Son of God. And that term had a lot of meaning behind it, right? That was a pretty significant idea. What are they actually accusing him of doing? Claiming what? Claiming divinity, to be God. And if he wasn't who he was, would that be a crime of the Mosaic law, a sin against the Mosaic law?
Yeah.
It would be. But their problem is what?
He is who he
says he is. And he also has what backing him up? His what? Yeah, the signs, the wonders, the miracles, right? He has all of those, plus all the prophecy he's fulfilled, plus God himself speaking. So he really has three witnesses, doesn't he? We talked about witnesses earlier. This is your three witnesses. He has prophecy, he has miracles, and he has God speaking on his behalf. Remember at his baptism, Also at his transfiguration in Matthew 17, those all back up that claim, and they've already admitted in other places they couldn't deny that those things had happened. And so their second attempt is blasphemy, claiming to be God. Now, Jesus doesn't deny that, does he? He says, yeah, that's true, basically. He doesn't say that outright, does he? But through his statement, that's what they imply or infer. With this, they feel like they've got what they need. And so the whole Sanhedrin cries out, what? Crucify him. He deserves death, they answer. And so now, since they have what they feel they need, they're going to now move to Pilate. Because again, though they may want to kill him, they don't have that power. And so now they're going to take him before Pilate, and that's what they do. Let's go to Luke 23. Luke 23. And we get into an interesting series of activities. This begins a whole series of things with Jesus being moved around from here to there. All right, somebody read verses. Let's read 1-5.
Then the whole multitude of them arose and led him to Pilate, and they began to accuse him, saying, "We found this fellow perverting the nation and forbidding to pay taxes to Caesar, saying that he himself is Christ a king." Then Pilate asked him, saying, "Are you the king of the Jews?" He answered him and said, "It is as you say." So Pilate said to the chief priests and the crowd, "I find no fault in this man." But they were more than fierce, saying, "He stirs up the people, teaching them throughout all Judea, beginning from Galilee to this place."
Okay, so we'll go on into 6 in a minute. But there are 3 accusations they bring. Now, remember, Pilate does not care one iota about the Mosaic law. And so accusing him of blasphemy is not going to move Pilate. And so now they change their tact, right? You don't hear these accusations leveled against him at the previous trial. But now they accuse him of 3 different things. What are they? Okay, that's the second one. What's the first one?
Perverting the nation.
He's perverting or misleading. Like he's putting out false information. And so fake news, right? And so they say he's misleading the nation. And in doing that, what is he doing? He's saying, don't pay your taxes, which is, obviously, Jesus taught the very opposite of that, but that's what they're saying. And then thirdly, what is it?
He's king.
He's king. King of the Jews. And so they bring these 3 before him. Now, what's interesting is that with the first 2, Pilate just doesn't really seem to think they're a big deal. What does he say in verse 4, Pilate? I don't find any fault in this guy. Now, John 18, if you'll hold your place here in 23, we're going to come back to that. But if you go to John 18 for just a minute, we have a little bit more of an elaborate conversation between Jesus and Pilate about this question of kingship, which is the one Pilate is going to spend more time on with Jesus, because this is the more demanding accusation. Now, we've mentioned this before, but what was one of the things that Rome did not want to have in any of their providences?
They liked peace.
They liked peace.
They didn't want any unrest.
And so anything like rioting, rebellion, was squashed and quickly and harshly. And that's what led to Pilate's downfall, is that he could never gain that control over the area. And in many ways, he was an instigator of it. And so this threat of rebellion, you're looking at this from Pilate's standpoint. He's not a religious man. So he's not looking at the kind of concepts we would in this situation. What his consideration is what could this man do as far as a rebellion? Now, one of the things he's going to note from what's happened the previous night is what? When Jesus was arrested, what did all his followers do?
Ran away.
He ran away. And so they're trying to say that he's some kind of instigator. Where are all his followers? If he was really leading a rebellion, where's the rebellion? And so he dives into this kingship question. Let's go to John 18, and let's read a little bit here. Somebody read, if you don't mind. Let's read 33 through 38. Or do 37. We'll get to 38 in a minute. But let's read John 18, 33 through 37.
Then Pilate entered into the judgment hall again and called Jesus and said unto him, Art thou the King of Jews? Jesus answered him, Sayest thou this thing of thyself, or did others tell it thee of me? Pilate answered, Am I a Jew? Thine own nation and chief priests have delivered thee unto me. What hast thou done? Jesus answered, My kingdom is not of this world. If my kingdom were of this world, then would my servants fight, that I should not be delivered to the Jews. But now is my kingdom not from hence. Pilate therefore said unto him, Art thou a king then? Jesus answered, Thou sayest that I am king. To this end was I born, and for this cause came I into the world, that I should bear witness unto the truth. Every one that is of the truth heareth my voice.
All right, so with this, we're going to get a series of questions by Pilate, as Pilate is trying Jesus, that are very fascinating. His first question is what? Are you a king? Now, again, it's very easy for us because we have studied the Bible and we've studied Old Testaments, prophecy and Old Testament writings, and we've studied the New Testament. We come at this from a spiritual mindset. Pilate's not doing that. And so when he hears the term king, what's the obvious thing he's going to think?
King of a nation.
King of a nation, right? And what had the Jews been really antsy to do for a long time?
Take over Jerusalem.
I mean, you see that unrest continues even to now. Right? The reestablishment of a Jewish kingdom. And so he's thinking geopolitics and what it's doing to him locally. What does this mean for me? And so he's asking the idea of a king. He gets an answer that I'm sure he was not expecting. What's Jesus' response to that?
My kingdom is not of this world.
Because if it was, what?
All of us would fight right now. Yeah.
Which was the thing he was looking for, I believe, when the whole rebellion ideal came up. Right? He's looking for rebellion, and he's not seeing anything. And so that's obvious to him. They're not fighting, yet they're saying he's claiming to be a king, and now he's talking about he's not a king of this world. And so he reiterates the question. He says, so are you a king? What's Jesus' response? Yeah, for this purpose I was born. This is my purpose in life. And so I'm sure at this moment he's really perplexed and like, what's going on here? Now, hold your place here in John 18. We're going to flip back to Luke 23. Now, there's something that the Jews say that he is going to key on. And we'll come back and talk about truth in a minute. But notice what happens. So, verse 5, they accuse him, his accusers accuse him of being what? One who stirs up the people throughout all Judea from Galilee to this place. Okay? What is Pilate key on? Let somebody read. Let's read verse 6 here. When Pilate heard this, he asked whether the man was a Galilean. Now, you ever do that when you're talking to somebody? You're about half listening, and then, but something's said, and you're like, whoa, what's that? And it like just triggers something in your mind. That's kind of seems to me what happens here with Pilate. He hears Galilean, he's like, oh, Galilean. Now, he's got a messy situation in front of him as he sees it. And so, how can I get rid of this problem? He's a politician. That's what they do constantly. Let me move the problem somewhere else, put it on somebody else's desk in front of them and away from me. If you continue reading, verse 7 says, when he learned that he belonged to Herod's jurisdiction, he sent him over to Herod, who was himself in Jerusalem at the time. And so he says, I've got a way out here. I'll send him over to Herod. He is a Galilean. Herod can take care of it. Galilee is not in my jurisdiction. And, of course, we know what happens, which is what? Yeah, when Jesus wouldn't do any of those, Herod said, take him back, right? He sends him back to Pilate. He says, I find no fault in the man. And so he has to come again before Pilate. And so Pilate isn't able to skate out of the issue like he thought he could.
Is this the guy that killed John the
Baptist? We were talking about this. Let me think back. I think so, yes.
Okay.
Yes, it is. It is. It's the same Herod. Sorry, I had to get my brain on Herod talk. But yes, this is the same guy that beheaded John the Baptist.
Who was more powerful, Pilate or Caesar?
Herod?
Yeah.
Nice. Caesar definitely had more power. That's an easy one. That's complex.
Yeah.
I would say it depends on who you ask at the time, right?
Wasn't Herod over a bigger area, though?
I don't know. That's a good question to ask. I don't remember. I think so, but that's me guessing. But Herod was definitely over Galilee, and so. He doesn't want to deal with it either, so he sends it back to Pilate. I'm going to go back to their conversation in John 18. So he asks the question, "Who are you, a king?" Another question he asks is he a Galilean? And then he asks another question, and it has about truth. So let's go back, John 18. You go to verse 38. What's the question Pilate asked? No, verse 38. What is truth? Now, that is based on the previous verse where Jesus said, he's talking about, are you a king? And he's answering. And he goes on to say, Jesus talking, verse 37. You say that I am a king. For this purpose I was born, and for this purpose I have come into the world, to bear witness to the truth. Everyone who is of the truth listens to my voice. So then Pilate responds, what is truth? Now, we can't know, because the scripture doesn't give, as far as I know, the background of why he's asking that particular question. But that is an important question, depending on your motive. The concept of truth. Truth is one of those things that today is very much under attack, isn't it? We see it all over the place. I can remember years ago now when it felt like, at least to me, I don't know the exact origin of it, but when, and it's probably something that's been going on since, you know, history began, but this battle over what is truth and what isn't. But I remember back in the early 2000s when people like Oprah Winfrey came on television and began asking the question of began proclaiming this idea of, you can have your truth and I'll have my truth, right? Or you heard, like, for some people say, that's her truth, right? You live your truth. You speak your truth. Of course, the concept of truth has been challenged for a very long time. But it really gets down to this discussion of, is there real identifiable objective truth that exists? Or is everything truly relative? Now, even a young child understands there are some things that are true and some that are not. It's always amazing to me that the age that children learn to lie. And dishonesty becomes a temptation even for our young ones. But what we know is there are certain things that are just objectively true and they're unchanging. And yet the world continues to attack truth. Why? Why is there such a war on identifying what truth is?
Sin.
Sin?
People want to do what they want to do.
Okay. Now, how does truth play into that? I agree, but how does truth play into the desire to do whatever you want to do? How does that have anything to do with truth? And I agree it does, but how? What's the interplay of the two? Okay.
I don't know what you're asking.
If there's no truth in the thinking is, then there's no God that I have to obey or submit to.
Okay. And then my behavior becomes whatever I want it to be.
It's like a seared conscience idea.
They can't be condemned if there's no truth.
There is no condemnation if everything truly is random and relative to your situation. How can you condemn me for what I believe or practice in my life or say with my mouth if there is no truth? And so the world continues to attack those things and will do so. I mean, we live in a time when people can no longer identify gender. Right? That's one of those things when you'd asked me that 5 years ago, well, maybe a little longer, 10 years ago, I would have thought that was the most ludicrous idea possible. No, we'll never get to a point where we can't even identify what is male and female. But that's where things are. And so Jesus says he's come to do what? To speak truth. Those who want to follow truth do what? Listen to my voice. Earlier, a chapter earlier in John 17... what did Jesus say about those who are followers of God? What does he ask from God? John 17:17.
God's word is true.
Yeah, he says, sanctify or set them apart from the world Sanctify them by what? By your word. Your word is truth. Did I get back to that? Sanctify them by. Oh, now I got myself questioning myself. I want to quote that properly. Sanctify them in the truth. Your word is truth. I want to say that right. Sanctify them by truth. Your word is truth. In other words, how do we know what God wants us to do? It's based upon this concept of truth, that there is something reliable, something we can hold on to, something recognizable as truth. And that's so vitally important for us as Christians, that there is truth, that we can know the truth, and that through it we can be set apart from the world. And as longer I live, the more that difference becomes more apparent. Those who do not believe in truth, those who have decided to live to their lust, and those who have decided to follow God, that stark contrast is becoming more and more evident the longer I live. So he asks, what is truth? There are a couple other questions here. If you go to Matthew 27, Matthew 27 and verse 18. He asked the question, let's go down here. No, that's not the one I was looking for. Wrote the wrong thing down. I'm not written that where I thought it did. Oh, here it is. I'm sorry. John 19:9. I had the wrong reference. John 19:9. So just a little bit past the text we were looking at earlier, he asked another question following in this interrogation of Jesus. What does he ask in verse 9? John 19:9.
Where are you from?
Where are you from? Now, That question is a loaded question, isn't it, for Jesus? So there is the question of Galilee, which we were talking about earlier, where Jesus, well, and he's not even, I mean, you could in a way say he's from Galilee, but that's not where he was born, right? But he was raised there physically. But then we know as Christians, as students of the Bible, that question goes a lot deeper. When you ask the question, where is Jesus from? Where is he from? From God. He's from eternity, right? He's from heaven. And so that question is one that is deep. The last question, I'll just mention this as we move forward, that he asked, is found just a little bit later. When he says, do you not know that I have the authority to what? Yeah, and what's the underlying feature of that question? What's Pilate misunderstanding in asking that question? Yes, and it's really a question of power. And he misunderstands who has the real power here. Of course, Jesus says, or Jesus had the power to have stopped this at any moment if he'd wanted, but he doesn't do that. And so he misunderstands what real power is. Jesus says that to him, right? I have the power to take up my life or to lay it down. All right, so thank you again for being here. We'll move on next week to a new study. I never have enough time to go over everything I'd like. But thank you for being here and taking part. We're going to dismiss and rejoin for worship in just a moment. Thank you.